with the vulnerability of Jerusalem suddenly terrifyingly manifest, the Jews asked the Almighty to acquire Jerusalem for himself, so that every empire's acquisition of the city, no matter how real it would have seemed, would not have a full and lasting effect. This is why, no matter how many times Jerusalem would be surrendered, it would never lose its hold on Jewish hearts. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, Episode 1, The Unconquerable, Constantly Conquered City. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. Early in the morning of December 9th, 1917, the Ottoman Empire informed the mayor of Jerusalem, Hussein al-Husseini, that it was retreating in advance of the oncoming British troops and that it would fall to the mayor to surrender the city. This would seem a simple task, but what unfolded in the next several hours, and the images of those moments that remain, tell us a great deal about the millennia-long history of Jerusalem and what the purpose of this podcast is all about. The first members of His Majesty's military that the Ottoman mayor encountered were reportedly one or two British cooks, privates, who had been sent by their colonel on an incredibly important mission, finding eggs for the officers' omelets. The earliest version of this tale can be found in the memoir of one of these British officers, Vivian Gilbert, who wrote about his World War I experiences in a volume titled The Romance of the Last Crusade. Gilbert describes a cook named Private Murch who, seeking victuals, suddenly encountered the elaborately attired mayor of Jerusalem, who announced to him, "I want to surrender the city, please. Here are the keys." Private Murch reportedly replied, "I don't want your city. I want some eggs for my officers." Gilbert adds, quote, "I happened to be at battalion headquarters when Private Murch, hot and out of breath, arrived. 'Where have you been for the last 4 hours?' demanded the colonel in a freezing tone. The perspiring private proceeded to relate his amazing adventures in a rich Cockney dialect. In spite of his rambling and at times incoherent recitation, it dawned on us at last that one of the great events in the history of the world, for which thousands had given their lives, had occurred. When the man came to the end of his story, the colonel turned to us and said quietly, 'Gentlemen, Jerusalem has fallen.' Then he seized a field telephone, rang up the brigadier, and acquainted him with the startling news." End quote. Meanwhile, the mayor then ran into two British sergeants, James Sedgwick and Fred Hercombe. We know this occurred because while the sergeants did not accept the surrender themselves, they did agree to be photographed with the mayor and with his band of men. A photograph that survives to this day. A photograph that we have provided for you. The mayor then met two British majors, F.R. Barry and W. Beck, who accepted the surrender. Accept. Then a brigadier general by the name of Watson arrived on his horse and insisted that the city be re-surrendered and then surrendered to him. And the mayor was then photographed with Watson as well. All this was much to the annoyance of Brigadier General Watson's superior officer, Major General John Shea, whose vehicle had been stuck some distance down the road and who had desperately wanted to be the man to whom the sacred city was given up. Thus Gilbert writes, quote, "Brigadier General Watson decided the only thing to do was to ride back to the city and hand the keys back to the mayor, who was informed that Major General Shea was now on his way to see him." End quote. We thus have another image of Shea and his officers marking the surrender of Jerusalem. Jerusalem had thus been surrendered 5 times by 11 a.m. Gilbert writes that Shea then proudly telegraphed his superior, General Allenby, telling him that, quote, "I have the honor to report that I have this day accepted the surrender of Jerusalem," end quote, and in turn received the following message. "General Allenby will himself accept the surrender of Jerusalem on the 11th. Make all arrangements." Thus it was that another surrender was held 2 days later in the eyes of all the denizens of Jerusalem. Meanwhile, the poor mayor had come down with pneumonia, apparently by being forced to surrender Jerusalem out in the cold again and again. He was, as one article puts it, the only casualty of the surrender of Jerusalem. Accounts of this day differ in various details. Was it keys or a letter transferred as a symbol of surrender? How accurate is the story of the cooks? On this, many disagree, but all are in accord on the most salient fact. Jerusalem was surrendered many times in a single day and again soon after. And the photographic remembrance of that moment thereby captures what Jerusalem is. It is a city that has fallen and been subject to surrender and conquest so many times. a city exchanged between empires and empires again and again, more than any other. From Israelites to Babylonians to Persians to Alexander to Ptolemy to the Seleucids to the Romans to Byzantium to Muslims to the Crusaders to the Ottomans to the British. The story of Jerusalem, like the story of December 9th, is the tale of the keys of the city, symbolically or literally, being passed from hand to hand. It is therefore easy to forget that once Jerusalem was seen by many as unconquerable. Hence, Jeremiah describes the destruction of Jerusalem in chapter 4 of his Lamentations as follows. The kings of the earth could not believe, nor any inhabitants of the world, that foe or adversary could enter the gates of Jerusalem. For consider, ladies and gentlemen, before Nebuchadnezzar, ruler of Babylon, destroyed the temple, the last great threat to Judah, Assyria, had been miraculously destroyed at the city gates. And as we will see, the city's security stemmed from it being built between steep valleys, and David himself, though the exact process remains mysterious, seems to have taken Jerusalem by entering an aqueduct utilized for funneling water into the city, not by storming its gates. Thus, it was only with the first destruction of the temple and Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar that the gates of Jerusalem were truly stormed. Thus, to this day, Jews mourn the destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar in 586 BCE, not only because it was then that the city first fell, but also because it was on that day that Jerusalem's vulnerability, its conquerability, was suddenly made manifest to the world, thereby making all future conquests possible. And yet, in the midst of these conquests, a student of history can mark a miracle. I was recently visiting friends of mine who live for most of the year in Jerusalem, right outside the old city walls. We were eating a meal together, and so I engaged in Netilat Yadayim, the ritual washing of hands before bread. Seeking to dry my hands, I was handed a towel by my friend, who had purchased it in a souvenir shop in Jerusalem. I began to dry myself off, and then I suddenly stared at what I was holding in my hand. I've sent you a link to an image of it. It is a towel known as the Jerusalem Timeline Dish Towel, listing upon it the rulers of the city throughout its history. Babylonians, Persians, Hellenists, Hasmoneans, Romans, Byzantines, early Muslims, Crusaders, Ayyubid, Mamluk, Ottoman, Britain, Jordan, complete with the dates of these respective reigns. I stood there, struck, and then suddenly thought, this towel would be useful for my podcast, and I really wanted to take it, which would have been a unique fulfillment of what Yogi Berra once said when he stayed in a hotel. The towels there were so thick, I could barely close my suitcase. But there was no need. My friends very kindly let me keep it. And it struck me, for a seemingly prosaic souvenir, as sublimely symbolic, for no other city could summarize its history in this fashion. There is no descendant today of the denizens of Sparta or Carthage or Tyre or Babel or Nineveh or Ur who marks the many rulers of those cities and then a return to those cities of their own people. Only a Jew could practice the faith of his fathers with a towel that itself highlights how the Jews have washed their hands of the residues of empires, marking a city's constant transfer of keys, and how the city remained the key to Jewish minds and hearts. This is expressed in a striking tale in the Talmud, which describes how when Jerusalem first fell to Nebuchadnezzar, the temple priests ascended to the roof of their sacred edifice, holding its keys in their hands, exclaiming before the Almighty, "Let the keys be given over to you," as a heavenly hand emerged and took it from them. It is a famous Talmudic tale, but one only understood through the more prosaic details of Jewish law. According to the Talmud, the handing over of keys in a real estate transaction is a silent expression of a desire to transfer ownership. Thus, what it's telling us is that at the last moment, as the city was being destroyed for the first time, with the vulnerability of Jerusalem suddenly terrifyingly manifest, the Jews asked the Almighty to acquire Jerusalem for himself, so that every empire's acquisition of the city, no matter how real it would have seemed, would not have a full and lasting effect. This is why, no matter how many times Jerusalem would be surrendered, it would never lose its hold on Jewish hearts. The keys could go back and forth between world powers, but the bond could never be broken between the sacred city and those who believed the keys of Jerusalem vouchsafed to the Almighty. The Talmud is telling us that Jerusalem became the constantly conquered city whose connection to the Jewish people could itself never be conquered. Thus, in 1917, as the British prepared to enter the Holy Land, the Zionist leader Chaim Weizmann met with Foreign Secretary Balfour to discuss Jewish sovereignty over Jerusalem. Balfour was initially perplexed. The sole Jew in the British cabinet at the time was Edwin Montague, a man who had sought to assimilate, a man who, like poor Private Murch in Gilbert's memoir, would have stoutly said, "I don't want your city." Balfour asked Weizmann why Jerusalem mattered so much, why a Jewish state could not be centered elsewhere. Weizmann replied, "Suppose I were to offer you Paris instead of London." And Balfour said, "But Dr. Weizmann, we have London." "That is true," said Weizmann, "but we had Jerusalem when London was a marsh." Balfour then asked, "Are there many Jews who think like you?" And Weizmann responded, "I believe I speak the minds of millions of Jews." "It is curious," Balfour remarked, "the Jews I meet are quite different." "Mr. Balfour," Weizmann said, "you meet the wrong kinds of Jews." If the loss of Jerusalem did not lead to what occurred to all other ancient peoples, it was because of what Jews believed about Jerusalem. God has the keys, and he in turn keeps them for the Jewish people. Understanding all this allows us to uncover another layer of meaning behind the first photograph taken on December 9th, 1917. Looking at it, we could see the mayor in the photo and the two sergeants to whom he attempted to surrender. But then, standing between the two soldiers, we see a teenage boy in short pants. Who is that? Though this is debated, according to some, that is Menashe Elyashar, who eventually became the Israeli Minister of Commerce in Jerusalem, but was then a young member of a Jewish family in the city, who had been invited along by the mayor on his mission of surrender, with the mayor reportedly telling him, "Witness a historical event you will never forget." Thus the book Jerusalem: History of a Global City describes what it calls this improbable scene as follows. Quote, "Mayor Hussein al-Husseini, leaning on a cane, a cigarette in his hand, stands proudly in the center of the group. Beside him are Menashe Elyashar, the two British soldiers, and a few curious people. Behind them, an exultant man bears the white flag. All are dazzled by the morning sun and look at the photographer for posterity." End quote. It is symbolically sublime. A Jewish boy pops into the picture for the transfer of Jerusalem between one empire and another. Improbable indeed, but ultimately entirely apt. For when we think about it, another aspect is thus revealed as the elderly mayor of Jerusalem surrenders the city with a young Jewish boy at his side. Throughout the thousands of years as the keys of Jerusalem went from hand to hand, the Jews were always, if you will, in the picture. Empires rose and empires fell, and if the Jewish people endured, it was because their belief in the vouchsafed keys endured. "Witness a historical event you'll never forget," so the mayor said to Menashe. The one constant throughout the historical events surrounding Jerusalem is that one people has been witness. One people has never disappeared. One people's link to Jerusalem ensured its immortality. Today, the return of the Jews to Jerusalem vindicates their faith, but it also indicates something else. That there is a God who holds the keys to history itself. That there is a larger providential plan, and one need not be Jewish to understand this. Thus, George W. Bush, marking Israel's 60th anniversary, said the following in Jerusalem to Israel's Knesset.
60 years ago, on the eve of Israel's independence, the last British soldiers departing Jerusalem stopped at a building in the Jewish quarter of the Old City. An officer knocked on the door and met a senior rabbi. The officer presented him with a short iron bar, the key to the Zion Gate, and said it was the first time in 18 centuries that a key to the gates of Jerusalem had belonged to a Jew. His hands trembling, the rabbi offered a prayer of thanksgiving to God, who had granted us life and permitted us to reach this day. Then he turned to the officer and uttered the words Jews had awaited for so long. "I accept this key in the name of my people." Over the past six decades, the Jewish people have established a state that would make that humble rabbi proud. You've raised a modern society in the Promised Land, a light unto the nations that preserves the legacy of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob.
In this series, Jerusalem 365, we will tell the story of this sacred city, from its earliest appearance in the Bible to its conquest by David, to the exchanging of its keys from empire to empire. But this will be no mere historical account. We will approach it from a biblical perspective, with the hindsight of history, seeking to discover providential poetry in the events that unfolded throughout the centuries, pondering how Jewish Jerusalem parallels the chosen people rising from the ruins, embodying a nation that phoenix-like refuses to die, standing today as the ultimate embodiment of our eternity and of the meaning in history itself. In December of 2017, the denizens of Jerusalem marked the 100th anniversary of Allenby's entry into Jerusalem and even reenacted it, complete with men attired in World War I British uniforms and those of Ottoman officials. Reading Allenby's original pronouncement was his actual heir, the current Viscount Allenby. As you can see on the video link that we have sent you, an actor playing General Allenby himself stood with the mayor of Jerusalem near Barakat and, in a scripted moment, said to him,
100 years ago, I stood here and I received the key to this wonderful city. And I think that 100 years later, it's about time that I return it.
And then he apologetically added, "It's a bit rusty." The audience laughed appreciatively, but the proper reaction was not amusement but awe, for the actor was essentially echoing words that the Almighty Lord of History has said to the Jewish people in our own age. "Some time ago, I received a key to this wonderful city. I think it's about time I returned it to you." The tale of the city and its keys will be told in the year to come. A tale of love and longing, courage and conquest, holiness and heartbreak, destruction and redemption, of empire after empire, and of one small people that remained and returned. I look forward to taking this journey together with you. This is Mayor Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow, signing off.